Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hello, Felicity. It's great to see you as always. And what you won't know, because as you and I and all our listeners know, I monitor our inbox, is we've had another email your lack of Guinness drinking.
Yes. God.
So this time the source isn't anonymous like the last one. So it was from Dave Baxter, who is a tasting room manager based in Los Angeles.
Do you know, after our last episode went out, I woke up the next day to an email from a tech guy in California entitled, "Never had Guinness? For reals?"
Okay. So obviously you're trending in California at the moment with your lack of Guinness. Anyway, Dave wrote in and he said, and I quote Felicity, "Love the pod. I'm officially writing in about Felicity's non-consumption of Guinness."
This is bullying.
I know. So he goes on to say, quote, "Felicity, get it done. You made a promise, and delivering on a promise within something like a month, let alone months plural, is something that anyone with a functioning moral compass has to care about." He does then say in brackets, "Am I overdoing it? I probably am." Yes.
Oh, God, I'm obviously the entertainment of the week in some places.
Yeah, so definitely. So Dave continues, "As an American," and I'm quoting him here, "in 2025, I can talk with all authority about operating on a broken moral compasses and double downing even when overdoing it." And then he says in all caps, "Don't be us. Do what you said you would do." And then he goes back to his all caps, "Consume your Guinness."
Well, Dave, the good news is that I am indeed a moral being. I did have a pint of Guinness.
Yay! Thank goodness for that. So many of us are now finally being put out of our misery, Felicity.
Yeah, that's right. After I got that email, I thought, okay. So I grabbed a friend and we went to the pub and I had one.
Okay, so please do share with us. After 2 months of anticipation, did you like it?
Okay, so there was a reason I didn't go and get it at the German pub. And I have to preface this that I've since spoken to people about what happened. Okay. I hated it.
Oh,
it was flat and boring. It was like dishwater. It tasted like nothing.
Oh, no.
But people tell me it's supposed to be malty and rich, and that's why it's so popular. And it's been suggested to me that as the German pub rarely serves anybody Guinness, the beer was probably too old and it was stale. So I'm back to square one and I have to go and try it next time. I'm in an airport. Let's change the subject.
Yes.
How about you, Luli?
Yes.
You're always willing to try something new. What have you discovered recently?
Okay, so yes, I discovered recently something new to me, which is Chinese wine.
Oh, really? Okay, so how did you come to be drinking Chinese wine?
Well, as you know, recently I was working in Sydney and Melbourne a couple of weeks ago.
I do, but I'm surprised that they were serving you Chinese wine.
Well, as you know, being an Australian, it's clearly a very long way from London to Australia, and you have to land somewhere en route. So I actually stopped off in Hong Kong for a little bit of work en route, and I visited 67 Pall Mall Wine Bar in Hong Kong whilst I was there.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So 67 Pall Mall is the London wine club that's been on a relentless expansion drive. They now have outposts in Switzerland and Singapore, and I think they're planning on opening in Bordeaux and Beaune.
Yes, correct. But they are also opening a large club in Melbourne as well later this year. Yeah. So regarding Hong Kong, so it's not like a full clubhouse like in the other locations, but currently a sort of smallish wine bar. I suspect they're sort of building up sort of brand awareness or brand visibility, kind of potentially pre a larger opening in Hong Kong. Anyway, so I was hosted by the lovely Man Lai, who's the manager at the 67 Pall Mall Hong Kong, and she and her wonderful sommelier team selected three Chinese wines, which we tasted together.
Okay, so I take it these are contemporary Chinese wines. There's another club in Hong Kong called Crown Cellars, which has a 3,000-year-old wine.
Wow. So Vitis vinifera for that.
No. From memory, I think it's a rice wine. It's got to be. But anyway, you can pick up this bronze jar and you shake it and you can hear this ancient liquid sloshing around.
Oh, so they tell you. Anyway, yes, that sounds amazing.
Literally, I didn't realise you had this suspicious side to you. Anyway, so tell me about your Chinese wines.
Yes, so definitely vinifera. So I really enjoyed them, actually. And it was amazing to have the opportunity to learn from the really experienced sommelier team there. And I learned about Marzalan, which is a grape I had not previously been aware of. But Manlai was telling me, and the sommeliers were telling me, is an iconic grape now used to make wine in China. So I discovered that Marzalan is a red grape variety, sort of hybrid of Cabernet Sauvignon and Grenache, and was originally from France.
And created in 1961.
Oh, goodness me, seriously, you know that?
Trivia player from way back.
I so need you on my pub quiz team when the topic's wine. Anyway, yeah, so in China, it was first planted in 2001, I learned, and is now considered a potential kind of signature grape for China. So what was really interesting at 67, so at the wine bar, they were doing this month-long event focusing on Chinese wines. And they've got this really cool thing. So one of the walls in the wine bar is basically like a giant chalkboard, and they'd fix the bottles up that you could taste by the glass onto the wall. So it was like a kind of giant map where they'd actually place the bottles where from the regions where they come from. So you could see sort of geographically where all the different wines were coming from in China.
Oh, look, I love Hong Kong so much. I bet you had a fantastic time. But do you mind if I ask you what's going on in Sydney and Melbourne? Tell me tales of home.
Okay. So firstly, I observed how busy the restaurants were. So I was in Sydney and Melbourne. So granted, primarily in the CBD and the central areas where I was working. But they were pretty full, the restaurants. And as one of the hosts said to me, she kind of said, what cost of living crisis when we were arranging to meet up? Because she was trying to book a table for us in Sydney on a Friday night and failing to find availability. Yeah, I know. And in Melbourne, I walked past on South Bank in Melbourne, past Nobu and Rockpool, the two restaurants, which are kind of side by side. So it was around 6:30, 7 o'clock on a Wednesday evening. And as you know, Felicity, neither of those restaurants are at the value end of the spectrum, and they were both pretty full.
They are not at the value end. No, that's right. I guess it's like London. There is a very serious cost of living crisis and a housing crisis in both Australia and London, but there are still plenty of very wealthy people. So what was your other observation?
Okay, so my other observation, Felicity, was that Australians are going soft.
Oh, I don't believe that for one minute. Oh, okay. Sorry, not so.
Oh, yes. So in the hotel I was staying in Sydney, there was a room service menu on one of these schmancy sort of in-room iPad things. So they had the different tabs for the different lists, the different sections. So on the menu, guess what they had alongside the tabs for, you know, breakfast, lunch, drinks. What else do you think they had?
I don't know. Tell me.
Pet in-room dining.
They're serving you cats and dogs. How is that going soft? That is so hardcore.
So obviously they weren't serving cats and dogs.
They're not eating the cats and dogs.
They were serving meals for pets. Well, for dogs anyway. So they had one meal, and it was called a, get this, raw puppy patty. So it was described on the menu as a raw Wagyu beef patty with pumpkin and a milk bun. And guess what? It cost $18.
Oh my God, Wagyu beef. Mm-hmm. That's from the cows that are massaged every morning. Yep. I would like to order that for the equivalent of 10 euros, though I might ask for it to be cooked.
Okay, so that wasn't the only pet-themed example I spotted whilst down under. So I was in a restaurant in Sydney and they were advertising Yappy Tuesday.
Okay, so they've not just gone soft, they've gone kitsch. What does Yappy Tuesday involve?
So it involves something called a porky. Okay, so that's spelled paw as in P-A-W hyphen key, K-I-E. And you get one of these with every meal that as a human being you order as a treat for your dog.
Okay, and what's a porky?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked. It's a mini Yorkshire pudding with kibble and gravy.
Oh, I want that too. I want one of those as well. Okay, so before I start drooling, what are we talking about today?
Okay, so back to today's question. So today's question comes in from somebody that actually I recently met on my trip to the US. So they were telling me that they had very kindly really enjoyed our episode on Prosecco, and they particularly enjoyed all of the historical, political and economic turns we were talking about.
Yeah, we actually got great feedback on that episode, and I'm so glad we told that story. Mm. Okay, so who's the friend, Luli? Does this person have a name?
This person does indeed have a name. So it was Matt, who is a client, well, now also friend of mine, and he works on the commercial side of a wine business in New York.
Not the drinking side.
Not the drinking side, the commercial side, yes. No. Yes. Well, yeah, let's not go there. So he mentioned the Prosecco episode, as I said, and he said that he learned lots of new things about Prosecco that he hadn't previously known. So as we were chatting about it, he said to me, now I want to know the backstory on champagne. And he went on to say, and particularly, who invented it?
Well, that's actually a great question, because the story of champagne is full of politics, riots, lawsuits, and some very unexpected facts about who invented it.
It is indeed, Felicity. So just before we launch into answering that question, who invented champagne, we also had another question on champagne, which we can address. So we can kind of do like a 2-for-1 episode.
Can you remind me of what that question was?
Yes, because of course I will know what that question is and not you.
Yes,
because I look at the inbox. Anyway, so it was from Katrina, and she's actually based in Texas. So we have like US-themed questions this week. And she asked, and again, quote, is there any difference in sugar content and calories across various champagnes? So she went on to say, asking for a friend who may or may not be middle-aged and more concerned with these things than they were before.
Do you know what? I'm trying to contain myself from going into my rant about how bottles of wine should have nutrition labelling, because so many people want to know about sugar and calories. But let's start by, would you be able to define what champagne actually is?
Okay, so that's a really good starting point. And actually, I think that's not as straightforward question as it might sound. I think that there are actually different ways we could potentially define champagne. So let's run through a couple of thoughts I've got on this. So we could talk about it being the method of production, so meaning wine made with a secondary fermentation in the bottle to give the bubbles. And that method of winemaking is termed method champenoise or method traditionnel. So that's A. Or we could do B, so the production of sparkling wine from grapes grown specifically in the Champagne delineated region in France, where, as we know, you can use the defined grapes, typically Pinot Noir, Chardonnay and Pinot Meunier, although other lesser known varieties can also be used. And then finally, another option, C, we could think about defining champagne as the creation of the kind of branded champagne houses that really we're more familiar with today. So there you go. There's a start of a 10. Three different options, different ways of describing or defining champagne.
Yes, I think for a lot of the general public, champagne is just means all-purpose sparkling wine. But the champenoise themselves are very clear on which one is correct. Yes. Point B, the production of sparkling wines from grapes grown in Champagne. And they do use the method champenoise. So anyway, if you are not from the region and you try and use the champagne name, they will come and they will sue your sorry ass.
They will indeed. Absolutely. So we can talk about, I can think of one particular lawsuit and one very large trade negotiation over legal naming rights using the term champagne. But let's do that in a bit. We'll come back to that because I think that's really important.
All right. So let's start with the question of who invented champagne.
Okay. Well, it's a really easy answer, Felicity. It was an Englishman. So it was the physician, naturalist and early member of the Royal Society, Christopher Merritt, who in 1662 documented how adding sugar to wine in the bottle caused the secondary fermentation, leading to the production of a sparkling wine in a bottle. So effectively, the traditional method we were just referring to, also known as method champenoise, as I just talked about.
I'm glad you said documented because Merrick didn't invent it. So English wine merchants were probably adding sugar to wine in the previous two or three decades. So Merrick delivered a paper to the Royal Society called Some Observations Concerning the Ordering of Wines, which he spelt W-Y-N-E-S, in which he noted that when wine merchants added sugar or molasses to wine, it made them, quote, brisk and sparkling.
Yep.
The manuscript can still be seen online on the Royal Society's website. But could you explain how the English came to be messing around with French wine?
I can. So as is often the case, and we often end up here when we're, whatever topic we're talking about to do with wine and history, all leading back to the fact that England was the trading hub for wine globally in the 17th century. So at the time, still wine was being imported into England, including still wine from the Champagne region.
Yeah, just let me interrupt and add that Champagne is in northeastern France and it's close to Paris. And at the time, Champagne was pretty much the geographic limits of where winemaking was possible because it was so cold. Mm-hmm. There has been winemaking in the region for more than 1,500 years, but sparkling wine only emerged in the late 17th century. So sorry, interrupting.
Good interrupt, well made. So at this time, the British, so particularly the upper classes, those with money and wealth, developed a taste for effervescent drinks by the kind of mid-1600s. So that included drinks like cider and beers, which obviously are kind of locally made, but also, get this, medicinal mineral waters. So effectively heavy mineral content sparkling water.
That is so interesting. Mm. Do you know, I was told there's a trend going on in the US right now about carbonation. Mm. So it turns out that consumers in the USA are getting picky about how carbonated something is. It's been fascinating. And we've been watching, of course, the growth of sparkling cocktails, RTDs, and sparkling wines of all types in the past 10 years. And now it turns out they were mad about bubbly 350 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. So we could say back then that was kind of consumer demand or market opportunity for a sparkling wine.
They just didn't realize it was a white space in the 17th century market.
Exactly. Blue ocean, white space, whatever we want to call it.
That's right.
But they just didn't realize it until the technology had made this possible. So still wine, including from Champagne, as I said, was being imported to Britain. But the really important point here was it was in barrels and then bottled in the UK. So there were two really key technological impacts here. The first of which was, significantly, glass bottles in England were much stronger than they were in France or elsewhere.
I know why this is.
Of course,
it's because
you do.
England had coal-fired glass furnaces. They had coal, which produced much stronger bottles or allowed them to make much thicker glass than the wood-fired furnaces in France.
Correct. Absolutely. Because the coal-fired ones, you can get higher temperatures, which then in turn leads to the production of the stronger glasses you were just referring to, meaning, of course, that the bottles could withstand the pressure of the secondary fermentation without the bottles exploding, which is quite handy, really, because that's what typically was happening elsewhere.
Yes, it was a health and safety issue, I'm sure. So how did we get to the secondary fermentation in the bottle part?
Okay, well, as you well know, Felicity, it gets quite cold in England and we have quite cold winters. So you've got the fermentation going on and that kind of stopped and then restarted, stopped in the cold weather in the winter and then restarted when the weather warms up in the spring. So we got this secondary fermentation occurring in wine that had already been bottled. Unless you had these big, strong English bottles, it would explode because the production of carbon dioxide obviously is part of the process of secondary fermentation.
You know, what's really interesting is this was also happening in the cellars in France because it was, you know, northern, cold.
Yeah.
And so exploding bottles were not just a health and safety hazard, they were also a commercial disaster. And yet the French themselves wanted still wines and they thought of sparkling wines as faulty and they rejected them.
Yeah. So the British wine merchants had worked out that if you added sugar before bottling, it caused this secondary fermentation to happen in the bottle when it was sealed. So you could control it rather than this sort of slightly random exploding bottle issue that was going on previously. So British merchants began deliberately introducing this process using the still wine imported from Champagne, which is why I'm saying this is genuine champagne and invented there, because it was champagne wine in it. Yes, bottled in England, but it had originated from there. So we can
trade body wouldn't be able to sue them.
Exactly. So that's why we can put the case forward. You know, simple, solved. It was invented by the English and recorded by Christopher Merritt.
Yes, and I should add that Merritt gave his lecture in 1662, which is more than 30 years before Dom Perignon, who's normally credited with the invention, and he was experimenting in Hautevilliers. So did Merritt get a cut from this? Did he get any of the proceeds? Did he die a happy man from all his champagne?
Yeah, well, having spotted his white space, blue ocean opportunity, yeah, market right. opportunity, yeah. So did he do well out of it? Well, no, he didn't actually.
Oh, no.
So his tenure...
He didn't patent it, the fool.
So his tenure at the Royal College of Physicians ended contentiously, shall we say, after the Great Fire of London in 1666, which destroyed much of the library that he had previously overseen.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. And it led to legal battles, excuse me, and he was eventually expelled from the Royal College of Physicians in 1681.
Okay, I think there's more going on than the fire burned down the library and they sued him.
Yes.
I think there's a story missing in there somewhere,
but
carry
on.
Yes,
and so he was also removed from the Royal Society in 1685. Apparently due to unpaid dues. Anyway, despite these setbacks, his contributions to science and winemaking endure. As you say, the copy you can still see in the records of the Royal Society. But by the late 17th century, some champagne houses, like Ruinart, for example, started to produce sparkling wines deliberately, although in small quantities. But you mentioned earlier about Dom Perignon, who often is credited with the invention of champagne. So tell us more about him.
Yes, the story is always that, you know, the secondary fermentation happened and he tasted it and he yelled out to the other monks, "Come quickly, I'm tasting stars." But what is true is he was a winemaking Benedictine monk and he did work tirelessly to improve wine quality in the region. And it's thanks to him that they came up with all sorts of new methods to do with grape pressing and blending and so on. But here's what's interesting. Because he was so into quality, he was working very hard to find ways to stop that spontaneous secondary fermentation because of the problem of, you know, exploding bottles and people thought it was a fault and so on. So he was definitely not looking for a way to preserve the bubbles.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Now, he died in 1715 and he's first identified as the inventor of champagne in 1821 in an account written by Dom Groussard, who was one of his successors. And then in the late 19th century, the French began to crank up the champagne marketing machine. Mm. And this is the first time that the famous quote, "Come quickly, I'm tasting stars," appears.
Yeah. So that's quite a long time later, isn't it? So I was, I read that winemakers and champagne, as you were just saying there, really didn't like the bubbles. And it wasn't until the story I was telling about the British aristocracy developing this taste for it in the 1700s that they really began to produce it in earnest.
Right. So let's just run through what happens. So 1662, Christopher Merritt presents his paper, but he's recording something that's already going on. A few years later, Dom Perignon is hard at work. He's thinking about wine blending. By the early 1700s, champagne houses like Ruinart notice the British taste for sparkling wine and they begin to make it and export it themselves. By the 19th century, sparkling wine production from champagne completely overtook still wine production from the region. And the wine begins to fly off the shelf and the Champenois begin to make loads of money, not just selling it to the British, but also to French aristocrats who developed a taste for it and to many other people, including the Russian court.
Okay, so I'm going to be controversial again, Felicity, because there's another claim that we should highlight here, that the Champagne region was not where the first method traditional secondary fermentation sparkling wine was originally or first produced in France.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So the Russians were buying the wrong wine.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But there are stated claims to the fact that Blanquette de Limoux, so from the Limoux region in Languedoc, so much further south than we've been talking about with Champagne, is in fact the oldest sparkling wine in France, apparently dating back to 1531.
That's interesting if it's a warmer region. And that's more than 100 years earlier than either Christopher Merritt or Dom Perignon.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another monk link again.
Yes,
there always is. So this time it's credited to the Benedictine monks at the Abbey of Saint-Hilaire, where it is said that they had been using a primitive method, now known as method ancestral, I love that word, which is where you put the wine in a bottle before it's fully fermented, and then the wine goes through the fermentation in the bottle.
Oh, okay. So we're basically talking about one round of fermentation, yeah. not two. So yeah. it's not quite it's not the same quite as the champagne same, method. How did they manage without their bottles exploding, or didn't it matter? Did they have no health and safety down south?
Yes, they didn't care. They didn't say, disposable monks. No, I don't
yeah,
know.
That's right.
No. But there was. Do you know what the secret was?
Tell me.
They didn't use bottles.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they used flasks and stoppered them with cork from the nearby oak forests.
Ah, okay.
Plus, it was very low in alcohol, relatively, which means less fermentation pressure. So it's kind of lightly sparkling. And on top of that, and this will be right up your alley, Felicity, they tried to bottle it on the right days astrologically for luck.
How interesting. Well, so much for astrology, because it was champagne that became famous, not them.
Yeah, well, I guess it's because they've been very good at both defining the territory and marketing it. That's from a champagne point of view.
Yeah, and actually, this is an interesting story we should get into, because champagne has a very unusual structure for a French wine region, which is that the grape growers and the wineries are separate.
Yeah, yes, unusual, as you say, for France, but that's not unusual, for example, in California or Barossa Valley, where it's business as usual. But in France, the winery and the vineyards usually belong together. So tell us about how that came about.
Well, basically, it's because of the nature of champagne making. So champagne really is about the process. So you've got to have great grapes to start, but then you need real expertise in blending, assemblage, different base wines, putting them together, you know, blah, 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 and then starting the secondary ferment, bottling and aging the wines. But like I said, champagne sits at what used to be the northern limit for grape growing until our friend global warming came along. So there was a lot of frost, a lot of unpredictable weather, and grape growing was very risky. You had to keep an eye on everything all the time. So this meant that the vineyard plots were typically very small, and there was just no way that such a small enterprise could develop the expertise required to make champagne.
Yeah, so you get the middlemen who became the expert in what they do, in this case, grape growing.
That's right. And so they became the champagne houses we know today. Because they were buying from so many different grape growers, of course, they had power and leverage. And they also developed sales and marketing expertise.
Yeah. So everyone's happy building their own specific areas of expertise, whether that be the grape growing, the blending, the marketing, as we would now call it. And of course, a suitable share of the profit gets passed back to the grape growers.
And of course, a suitable share of the profits did not get passed back to the grape growers. So that meant there were always tensions. And there were other tensions as well. So champagne had become a byword for luxury, and the champagne houses wanted to protect that. So in 1882, they formed the Union des Maisons de Champagne, which, I'm saying in German, yes. which reinforced their power.
Yeah. So now, as a grape grower myself, I'm clearly exposing my bias. I want to know what happened to the grape growers.
Well, there wasn't really much they could do. But by the end of the 19th century, it didn't matter because they had a much bigger problem on their hands.
Okay, so let me guess. If it's not a trade war, then surely it's got to be something to do with disease. So those two being two of the biggest impacts in wine generally. So phylloxera?
Correct. Yeah. Yes, it's an insect so devastating that its original name was Phylloxera vastatrix, which is Latin for ravager or destroyer.
There's a name.
So, yeah, that's right. I think the Latin name has actually changed, but I find that vastatrix very evocative. Anyway, a native of North America, it's an insect that feeds on grapevine roots and disrupts the flow of nutrients and water, and eventually the vine dies. So they first noticed this because vines began to die in the Rhone Valley in the early 1860s. And from there, it spread right across the continent. By 1889, France had lost between 60% and 90% of its vineyards.
Extraordinary, isn't it? And the rampaging didn't stop there. It spread then across Europe. But how did it get from Europe to America in the first place then?
Well, it actually comes from America to Europe. And we have to blame the English for this.
Oh, really?
So nobody's nobody's absolutely certain, but it seems that some British botanists collected specimens of American vines and they brought them back to Britain. And of course, they brought the insect back with them. And unfortunately, there was no cure. People tried everything. Some growers, believe it or not, even put toads under the vines, hoping it would suck out the poison.
Wow. And so how did the growers in Champagne, we're talking about in particular, get back on their feet?
Well, the only solution, and this was done across Europe, was to graft their grapevines onto the roots taken from American vines because they were resistant to phylloxera. But the problem was these American vines were a different species. So there's a lot of resistance to doing this, but, you know, there was no other solution, and still isn't, by the way. But in the meantime, the vineyards did recover, but the growers had gone broke.
Yeah, and this is a period also, if we sort of blend into the story, blend into the story on fake champagne. So that was really coming in at this time. So when bottles were called champagne and being sold as champagne, but the grapes were coming from the less affected regions like the Languedoc or Provence further south, as we were just talking, or even table grapes from, dare I say it, Turkey or Greece, or sometimes even from outside Europe being labelled as champagne.
That's right. And not surprisingly, the growers got angry. In the late 1890s, they formed unions of their own, which in 1904 became the Syndicat Général des Vignerons. Mm. But for all of that, things did not get much better, even with new plantings, because first of all, they had no bargaining power. But secondly, the houses were profiting from cheaper wine from elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. And if I may, French history tells us that the French don't necessarily take things lying down.
They did not. It led directly to the Champagne Riots of 1911, where growers and other locals, they wreaked havoc. They smashed casks, they attacked warehouses. It was so bad, the French army had to be brought in to restore order.
Yeah, so this then is what led to how we got to the appellation system, so the kind of control system that we now know.
That's right, yes. So the authorities began to define the boundaries of Champagne, and in 1936 the region became part of the AOC system, or Appellation de Origine Contrôlée. Mm-hmm. And since then, Champagne has been legally protected. But one of the consequences of that is that they really protect it. Mm. The issue of other people calling it and fakes and so on is particularly important in Champagne.
Yeah. So do you think that the creation and protection that they put in place of this sort of legal status of this geographical area of Champagne is always beneficial to the different sort of parties involved here? So the growers, winemakers, and I'm also thinking of other sort of inhabitants, residents of the region, sort of economically and socially.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not only does everybody know the name, but it's a byword for luxury, and it couldn't possibly have that if the name was diluted.
Yeah, but I wonder whether this sort of, one could say, ultra-protectionism of Champagne can also be counterproductive as well.
Okay, I've got the feeling this is going somewhere. I await with interest what you're about to say.
Okay, so do you remember earlier we were talking about trade disputes and suing and et cetera, et cetera? So I'm thinking here about the legal dispute between the Australian wine educator Jane Powell, who called herself Champagne Jane.
Right, yes.
And the CIVC, so the sort of controlling body, which centred on her trademark usage and the consumer protection laws.
Yes, I do. I remember that very well. That was a terrible story.
Well, you remember it well, because as always with everything we seem to talk about it, you wrote an article on it at the time.
I did. And I remember speaking to her. She was very distressed.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. So she, Jane, adopted the moniker Champagne Jane. And she did this back in 2003 and registered it as a business in Australia, as a business name, in 2009.
That's right. She did a lot to promote Champagne and other sparkling wines through events, social media, publications, all sorts of things in Australia. So in 2012, she applied to register the name Champagne Jane as a trademark, and the application was accepted by IP Australia.
Indeed. Absolutely. But then in 2013, so the following year, the CIVC very immediately launched legal action against Jane Powell, alleging that she was making people believe that she was officially affiliated with Champagne, and that she was potentially diluting the Champagne brand.
Yeah, it was absolutely brutal. The CIVC embarked on a long and expensive legal campaign to get her trademark revoked and to stop her from using the name. And I remember, you know, not only was she really hurt because she'd done a lot to promote Champagne, but she was worried she was going to lose her house.
Yeah, I know. So the court case was heard in Australia in 2015, and the findings of the court basically dismissed the CIVC's claim that she or using Champagne Jane constituted misleading or deceptive conduct in general. And they made the CIVC pay her legal costs.
Yeah. But you know what? There's actually more to this story. Mm. She didn't just take that name. She'd been using that name for years. And the Champenoise really appreciated the work she did. The CIVC, the trade body that eventually sued her, had previously made her a Dame Chevalier to thank her for all her tireless work in promoting champagne in Australia.
Yeah, I know. And that's not the only case. So the media reports back in 2013 that the CIVC were going to sue Apple for an iPhone whose colour they called champagne. You know me and my colours. I love a colour. So, yeah, so Apple were going to use the name champagne as a colour. They told the media they were looking into options, and then sort of the whole story went quiet. So perhaps the two giants worked out something between them to not use that.
Yeah, that's probably not a public relations triumph for either of them. And don't forget, the other thing is producers who make sparkling wine using that secondary fermentation are not allowed to say it's method Champenoise. They have to call it method traditionnel. Mm. So the champagne body does not leave any stone unturned, that's for sure.
No, no. And there's also friction, for example, between champagne and the Americans, who for decades had been using the term champagne for American-produced sparkling wines. So it's been a long-standing point of contention rooted in differing approaches to geographical indications and trade agreements that we were referring to earlier.
Do you know what happened?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked. So the historic and political context was here that in the early 20th century, American winemakers began labelling their sparkling wines as champagne. So in the US, alcohol, as you know, is controlled by the TTB. So it's the US Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, and they classified champagne as a semi-generic term. So this means under this classification, American producers could use the term champagne, provided, and this is the real key, provided it was accompanied by the actual place of origin. So Californian champagne.
I'm actually really surprised they didn't sort that out in one of their trade discussions. You know, back when I started drinking wine, which was in the 90s, Australian winemakers...
Several hundred years ago.
Thank you. Yeah, but Australian winemakers were still using terms like claret and hermitage. But that all got stopped pretty fast thanks to international agreements.
Yeah, well, France has tried. So they lobbied ferociously for international recognition of champagne as a protected geographical indication. So in an effort to harmonise wine labelling practices and protect GIs, the US and the European Community, now European Union, signed an agreement in 2006. So the US agreed not to approve any new wine labels using these kind of what were defined as semi-generic European terms like champagne or port or sherry. But, and there was a very big but here, there was a grandfather clause.
Grandfather clause. That's a great term. I know. What was the grandfather clause?
I know, I love that name. So American producers who had previously been using the term Californian champagne before the 10th of March 2006 were allowed to grandfather to continue using it, provided they clearly said Californian champagne. So today, a limited number of American producers, so ones like Corbel or Cook's, who are two of the largest volume producers of sparkling wine in the US, can continue to use the term champagne under this grandfather clause. As you can imagine, though, the French are not that happy about these exceptions.
You know what? As you're speaking, this explains something I've always wondered about. So let me tell you a story.
Okay.
Back in 2008, it was February 2008, in fact, I'd only been in Europe for a couple of months, and I was working at Meininger's publishing house, and we got a press release from the Belgian government saying that they had seized a shipment of counterfeit champagne and they were going to destroy it in a live ceremony, and they wanted journalists to come along and write about it.
I mean, I shouldn't laugh because that's obviously horrendous for the, you know, supply chain people, but seriously, they're doing like this live destroy champagne. So this was American champagne?
It was. It was Gallo André champagne.
Okay. So I'm amazed that Gallo, being the exceptional company they are and super savvy, would have made a mistake like this. Or was this allowed under this grandfather clause I was just referring to?
No. So Gallo were legally allowed to keep their name, but they weren't allowed to sell it to Europe. And of course, Gallo, they've got lawyers up the wazoo. They were not making an attempt to sell it to Europe. What had happened was a third party had bought about 3,200 bottles, and this third party was exporting it to Nigeria. So the ship carrying it docked in Antwerp, at which point it was boarded by customs agents and the bottles were seized.
Okay, that seems really extreme, because you're basically saying this was en route to and was not being offloaded.
That's right. Yeah. So I thought, when I got the press release, I thought, this is really weird. So I contacted all the Belgian writers I knew and I asked them to go and cover it, and not a single one would agree.
Why? Why wouldn't they do it?
Well, first of all, they thought it wasn't a story and they just accepted that it was a good thing. Mm. They accepted the idea that Gallo was involved in some sort of nefarious counterfeiting ring, which I just couldn't believe that it was.
No, but you clearly thought this was a story.
I did. It seemed to me such an extreme action to go searching for goods destined for another market and then make such a public display of the destruction. So, strangely enough, I was actually in Belgium the day they did it. I was with another member of the editorial team, and we had an appointment to talk to the European Minister for Agriculture. And I kept watching the clock, hoping I'd somehow get out the door and go and watch the bottles being crushed. But you know, you do not get in and out of European Parliament very easily. So I didn't make it.
So what happened was, did big crush happen?
It did. And in fact, you can still see the video on YouTube.
No.
So they dropped all the bottles into a skip, and then there's this machine that goes in and crushes them all, and then the machine withdraws and it goes back in and it crushes them again. So a journalist, I think it was from one of the news agencies, actually did go along, and this story was in all of the major world news the next day. So I was furious that we hadn't covered it.
Yeah. So we should reiterate at this point that Gallo was one of the companies that was allowed to continue using the champagne name, Champagne from California, which they still do today under this trade agreement between France and the US.
So this shipment, of course, had been seized on a technicality. But what it was really about was, it was a symbol of French anger, like real anger, that, you know, they hadn't been able to stamp out the use of that name, Champagne in California, when they were doing that trade deal in 2006. So they were making a big deal about it. And they used counterfeit in all of their press communications, even though it clearly was not counterfeit in any real sense of the word, because Gallo was not trying to pass it off as something else. So, of course, we should mention that the reason those brands still use the name Champagne, and the reason that the French are so keen to protect it despite, you know, everything, is because it has so much cachet. And indeed, many consumers all over the world will say they're drinking champagne or ordering champagne, when what they mean is Prosecco or some other sparkling wine.
Yeah, so that, I think that's really important from a consumer point of view. So we were just talking about the US there. So if we take the US market, so there are over 60 million people who drink sparkling wine in the US. That's according to IWSR data. So 2/3 of them state that they drink sparkling wine or champagne from the US, so domestically produced sparkling wine, compared with 1/3 who drink champagne from the Champagne region. So basically, there are twice as many Americans who drink local US produced sparkling wine versus from Champagne. So having said that, though, and not surprisingly, if we look at the quality perceptions amongst US drinkers, not surprisingly, French Champagne is considered to be of significantly higher quality from a perception point of view than Californian Champagne amongst US drinkers.
I should say something about this perception of champagne as being a luxury product. And it's actually Pauline Vicard at Arini who told me about this. So one of the reasons that champagne is synonymous with luxury is, of course, the way they make it takes a lot of time and a lot of care and a lot of craft, right? But apart from that, it's partly because of a deliberate decision to position it like that. So Louis XIV, the so-called Sun King, fostered and promoted the creation of luxury goods as a deliberate economic policy. So the French government established strict quality controls, and basically, they decided they were going to be the arbiters of European taste. And so champagne was part of that.
Yeah. Okay. So, but here's a question for you then, based on that. Given that consumers, and in my experience, this is consistent globally, do you think they actually prefer the taste of champagne or other sparkling wines? Yeah.
Okay, this is going to be a trick question, isn't it?
Yeah, sort of. Okay, so there's a great academic paper that tested just this.
Okay, tell me, what does it say?
Okay, so the paper is entitled Understanding Consumer Preferences for Australian Sparkling Wine versus French Champagne. And it was published in the Journal of Beverages in 2016 and written by 8 academics who are based at the University of Adelaide in Australia.
Yeah, just an aside, the French Champagne, because of all their efforts to protect the name, is of course an oxymoron. Yes. Champagne can't be anything but French. Okay, so do you think the Australian researchers were biased in any way?
Well, that's a really good point. And I really did look into this, given that this paper was written in Australia and the sample and the respondents were Australian drinkers, but it is a peer-reviewed journal. But I think most importantly, the study was conducted blind. So that means the participants, when they were tasting the samples of both champagne and Australian sparkling wine, didn't know which ones they were tasting. So the study explored whether Australian wine consumers preferred a range of Australian sparkling wines or a range of champagnes. And they looked at the taste and the sensory differences. And then the third part of the study was how the brand cues, like the origin and the label, might then go on to affect consumer perceptions.
I'm waiting. Okay. What did they find?
Okay. So what they found was, well, first off, they did the chemical analysis of the wines. So not surprisingly, the French champagnes showed less variation in their technical chemical composition. So that clearly reflects the stricter production rules under the AOC system. In contrast, the Australian sparkling wines were much more diverse in style, so some more closely resembling French champagne, but others really far away.
I suppose that makes sense. I mean, if there are more rules governing the production for French champagne than there are of Australian sparkling wine, it makes sense that there's a much wider diversity of styles.
Yeah, exactly. So when it came to the sensory profiles, so the descriptive analysis they did, the higher priced wines from both countries had more complex sensory traits, which we would expect. So things like being more yeasty, more toasty, and more aged aroma characteristics. And that compares with the cheaper wines, which were fruitier and less complex, particularly the $12 Australian sparkling wine.
Yeah, well, I guess very surprising. No. So there are real sort of chemical and sensory differences in champagne versus cheaper Australian sparkling wine. So you would expect, and you get different flavour profiles.
Yeah. But which style do you think the consumers prefer the taste of? And remember, the respondents in this study were tasting a series of wines in random order and blind.
Well, I would hope that my compatriots would prefer the Australian wine, Lily.
Okay. So the results very clearly showed that the $12 Aussie sparkling wine was the one that was liked the most when tasted blind, and the $70 French champagne was liked least on average. So reiterate, this is when the wines were being tasted blind and the drinkers had no idea which wines they were tasting.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it actually makes sense. It's probably in the end not about quality, but about what you're used to. So if your palate is used to $12 sparkling, then that's what you like over something that's more unfamiliar.
Yeah. Plus, the consumers were unable to identify the country of origin or price accurately during the blind tastings. Which actually for me doesn't surprise me, because you need quite a level of expertise and experience to be able to kind of discriminate between. And I think that's particularly true in sparkling wines, and is certainly what I've seen over the years working with consumers. So I'm going to do a minor tangent time, if that's okay. So I'll tell a story, very quick one. I remember many years ago, back in Wine Intelligence days when I was running that business, we did a study called the Champagne Diaries, where UK consumers had to keep diaries about all of the experiences they had with buying and drinking champagne over a number of months.
And I bet they all lied and said they were regular drinkers of champagne. Now, the reason I'm saying this is not to accuse the British of anything, but because I just read a paper about teenage underage drinking in Australia, and the girls all claimed to be drinking champagne, which I guarantee they were not.
No, but they were probably drinking Australian sparkling wine and thinking champagne. Back to where we were. Well, anyway, back to this paper. So one of the key findings was that in the majority of cases, in the Champagne Diaries study I was talking about, they didn't know what champagne or indeed what sparkling wine they were drinking. Because if you think about it, typically when we're drinking sparkling wine or champagne, somebody else is selecting it for you and serving it to you. So you're simply just given a glass of fizz that's put in your hand. So the key occasion at which we consume champagne and sparkling wine for most of us is the occasion at which we don't know what the brand is. We don't really know what we're drinking because somebody else is making that decision for us.
So despite the very best efforts of the Champagne Marketing Board and their lawyers, consumers still equate sparkling wine with champagne. Mm. So tell me, did the consumers in the Australian study get to see the labels at any point?
Yeah, so they did. So they did the sensory analysis, the chemical analysis, and then they did the blind tasting. And then at the end, they showed the respondents the wines, the labels of the wines they'd tasted. And they found, of course, that after they saw the label, they assumed the French wines were more expensive.
Okay, so I guess champagne is on track to keep its prestige intact. And what about its sales?
Yeah, so there's been quite a lot of shifts, particularly in the last 5 years or so, in the consumption of champagne. So the Champagne Trade Association has said that shipments of champagne globally were down nearly 10% in 2024, and that's compared to the previous year in 2023, with consumers in key markets such as the US and actually domestically in France cutting down on champagne consumption significantly, partly driven by economic and political anxiety. So Maxine Toubart, who is from the Joint Trade Association, said, quote, champagne is a real barometer of the state of mind of consumers.
Yeah, that's what's that quote about you drink it in victory, you drink it in defeat.
Yeah.
Okay, so champagne might be facing woes, probably short-term ones, but this could be a good time to talk about the way that champagne has changed the fate of other regions. So there are many places in the world that have set out to imitate champagne and have had good results as a consequence.
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, we haven't mentioned it in this episode, but we should absolutely be thinking about Cava in Spain. So it's made in the same way from, obviously, the local grapes in Spain. And is an outstandingly, if I may say, good value for money. And then there's one of my favourites, so Franciacorta from Italy.
Yeah, that's right. So Franco Zilliani, a winemaker, applied the champagne method to Pinot Bianco in the 1960s, and the wines sold out. So now Franciacorta in Lombardy is a whole region that's devoted to traditional method sparkling.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, then we go further north up to Trentino, there's more.
That's right. The name here is Ferrari. So Giulio Ferrari began in 1902 aiming, and he set out to rival champagne. And so today Ferrari wines are very important in Italy. They show up all over the sort of, you know, events. And then there's the story of Russia.
Okay, so Russia. So I thought they were historically one of, you said earlier, they were one of the biggest buyers of champagne. So that's why we see all those shipwrecks in the Baltic Sea full of champagne that were heading for Russia.
Well, it's true. The Russians really love champagne and they loved it so much and they were spending so much money on it that the imperial court decided it was time that they made their own. So the Romanovs called in an agronomist to pinpoint somewhere in Russia that would be suitable and to go and get vine cuttings.
So where is that?
Okay, so it's in the south and it sits, there's a place called Abradurso, which was the imperial winery, and it sits overlooking a stunning teal-coloured lake.
Okay, so from your description of a stunning teal-coloured lake, I'm guessing you've been there. Of course.
I have. I've been there twice.
That's greedy.
But what's important about Abradurso is that the first person overseeing it was somebody called Prince Golitskin. Now, he was this absolute wine nerd and he went on to found not just big collections of wines but also some very famous wineries in Crimea. They also, Abradurso also got in a French winemaking team and eventually the wines were good enough to be served in the imperial court. And then came the Russian Revolution and the French winemakers all fled.
Okay, and then somebody started it up again?
somebody certainly did. Yeah. The winery was nationalized after the revolution and continued to make sparkling wine, which was called Sovetskoy Shamponsky. Sovetskoy Shamponsky. But guess who was behind it?
I do not know. Go on, tell me.
It was Joseph Stalin, the uniquely murderous dictator who was directly responsible for the deaths of between 6 and 9 million people. And that may be an underestimate. But he did one nice thing in his life. He'd grown up in the country of Georgia, where wine is an important part of everyday life. And he thought that champagne should be available to the masses. So he cranked up production. Now, guess how he did it?
Well, knowing my very weak history on him, but a little bit, is it by threatening to kill people if they didn't do it?
Yeah, he probably did that too. But in 1930s, they found a Russian winemaker who created what we now call the tank method.
Okay, so really, so I'm going to call you out on this one. So this is the method of secondary fermentation, which takes place on a mass scale in a steel tank instead of a bottle. But was that a Soviet invention then, you're saying?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so I'm going to call you out on this. In our previous episode on Prosecco, you called it the Marinotti method, and you said it came from Italy, and that's how Prosecco was born.
So it's both things are true. So the Soviet tank method was a more industrial process than the Italian one. So the Italian one just takes place in a single tank, and the Soviet one, they put a lot of interconnected tanks together that the wine could kind of swirl around in, so you got higher volume production. So the Martinotti or the Charmat method is just a single tank.
Okay, so you're kind of right on both counts. Okay. So what happened to finish the story in Russia? Where did it end up?
So after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it fell into complete ruin. But it was considered a Russian sort of, you know, treasure because of its history.
Of course,
so in 2006, it was taken over by Boris Titov, who was the Russian ombudsman and an oligarch. And today it's his London-educated son, Pavel, who has it. And he's turned Abrodusso into a massive tourist destination, which also produces millions and millions of bottles of sparkling wine.
So I'm guessing in amongst all of this and what we've been talking about earlier, that they have to call it something else, not champagne.
Well, that's actually a really funny story.
Okay.
So in 2011, the Russians agreed to stop calling it champagne, but the name Shamponsky holds a special place in Russian history. And so the French have allowed them to use that Russian version of champagne on the label as long as they print it in Cyrillic alphabet.
Okay, so that's such a way round, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. All you need is a wily lawyer.
And a different alphabet would be quite handy as well.
Yeah,
so
that's
goodness
right.
me. So this simple question then of who invented champagne has taken us literally all the way around the world. But to finish up, we should return back to Katrina's question, because remember, we're doing a 2-for-1 on this episode. So if you are reminding us, she said, is there any difference in sugar content and calories across various champagnes? And if you remember, she said, asking for a friend who may or may not be middle-aged and more concerned about these things than they were before.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, I think that all wines should be labelled with calories and sugar because so many people care about this. Anyway, so break it down for me.
Okay, so champagne comes, as we know, in different sweetness levels. And that's where the sugar, so the calorie difference, comes in. So there are lots of difference, but the main different types of champagne from the drier end to the sweeter end are extra brut with under 6 grams of sugar per litre, for example. And then next up on the sort of sweetness rung is brut with less than 12 grams per litre. And then
just to put that in context, 5 grams is about how much you have in a teaspoon of sugar. So if you have a teaspoon of sugar in your tea, say that tea is 200 mils, you know, extra brut is negligible in terms of sugar.
Yeah, because we're talking about a litre here,
not
a single cup of tea. So actually it's relatively, it's a really good call out, relatively proportionally small. Yeah. And then you go up to the much kind of sweeter end of the scale. So there, the sort of demi-sec, you might be up to 50 grams of sugar per litre. So the sugar mostly comes from something called the dosage, which is adding the sugar after the fermentation that gives champagne its level of sweetness that I was just referring to. But, of course, there's also the natural grape sugar, known as the residual sugar, that can sneak in as well.
You know, one of the most interesting things about sugar, just going back to the Russians, when they've pulled out those bottles from the bottom of the Baltic Sea and tested them, because it's cold and so they, you know, they retain their freshness and flavour, it turns out that they are so full of sugar by modern standards that most modern consumers wouldn't be able to drink them.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the alcohol itself, of course, also contains calories. And in the case of champagne, this is typically about 12% of alcohol by volume.
Yeah. So what this means is what's in your glass, Katrina. So it's about, typically, if you're drinking a brut champagne, which is the most common style or voluminous style, it's about 80 to 90 calories in a typical 125 ml pour of champagne.
Yeah. But honestly, if your friend is sticking to brut or choosing extra brut, the calorie difference between them is, you know, or between brands is minimal. It's maybe 10 calories either way.
Yeah, exactly. So there really is minimal difference between the different brands within those same kind of sweetness categories, and even between the drier end styles. So, Katrina, the good news is just drink the champagne you like. So, Felicity, let's sum up. Who really invented champagne?
The British, sort of. They didn't mean to, but they had strong bottles, they had coal, they had cold weather, and they had a taste for fizzy things. And the French turned that into a global luxury brand.
And now, thanks in no part to small part to global warming, the British are making sparkling wine again and doing it so well that champagne houses are now investing in English vineyards.
It's a full circle. So the drink that defined French elegance might owe more to British accidents than anybody wants to admit.
I think that is another question of drinks mystery solved, Felicity.
That's right. And if you've got a question for us, as opposed to bullying emails, send them to aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com and Luli will definitely read it.
I will, as always. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.